The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is John Ivey for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sports Illustrated for Kids. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the July-August 2022 issue of Sports Illustrated for Kids. And we're going to go to page 8, Who's Who, and we're going to go to our final line. And we have Marcus Smart, Boston Celtics guard. His height is 6'4". His weight is 220 pounds. He was born March 6, 1994, in his hometown, Flower Mound, Texas. Smart became just the sixth guard to win the NBA Defensive Player of the Year award last season, when he also set a career high by averaging 5.9 assists per game. In Game 7 of the Eastern Conference Finals, he scored 24 points and had 9 rebounds as the Celtics beat the Heat 100-96. Smart was Big 12 Player of the Year as a freshman at Oklahoma State. Did you know, though, the previous most recent guard named Defensive Player of the Year was Gary Payton of the Seattle Supersonics in 1995-96? Johnny Gaudreau, Calgary Flames left wing. His height is 5'9". His weight is 165 pounds. He was born August 13, 1993. His hometown, Carneys Point, New Jersey. Gaudreau finished second in the NHL in points last season with 115, 40 goals and 75 assists. As the Flames had the second-best record in their history, he also led the NHL in plus-minus, plus 64. After Calgary drafted him, Gaudreau spent 3 seasons at Boston College, leading the Eagles to the 2012 National Championship. But did you know Calgary's Elias Lindholm and Matthew Tkachuk also reached 40 goals last season, the first time 3 Lion mates hit that mark since 1993-94. And finally, we have Catherine Sandercock, Florida State Seminoles pitcher. Her height is 5'10". She was born August 1st, 2000, in her hometown, McLean, Virginia. As a senior, Sandercock finished second in the country with 30 wins as Florida State advanced to the NCAA regional finals. She picked up all 3 victories as the Seminoles won the ACC tournament. Sandercock had an ERA of 1.44 and threw 6 complete game shutouts. Did you know, though, the NCAA record for wins in a season is 52, set by Courtney Blades of Southern Mississippi in 2000. She lost just 7 times that season. Now moving on to page 34. Big reading on the top of page 35, Maximum. And shows here, looks like it's Max Vanderstappen. In a race, born to racing parents, Max Verstappen has always been drawn to speed. Now, as Formula One is making a splash in the United States, he's helping draw new fans to the sport. Looks like he's in maximum overdrive. A simple question drew Max Verstappen to racing. How fast can you go? That simple notion of getting behind the wheel of a go-kart and then a car and pushing it as far and as fast as it can go started Verstappen down the road that would see him become the best driver in the world. And he got there quickly, naturally. The speed, being low to the ground, really trying to find the limit of the car and also the limit of yourself, the 24-year-old Verstappen says, and of course the engine, the smell of the fuel, these kind of things at the time were really interesting to me as a kid. If anyone was born to race, it was Verstappen. His father, Jos, a former Formula One driver, and his mother, Sophie Kumpen, was an elite go-kart racer. So young Max spent plenty of time around the track, but his parents never pushed him to drive. But when Max, who was born in Belgium, but competed for the Netherlands, decided he wanted to get into karting, Josh insisted that he give it his full attention. At the track, if other kids were kicking around a soccer ball, Max would be with his dad, talking about the kart or the track. "I fully understand why," says Verstappen. "You have to have that mentally from a young age to just work harder, because there are a lot of talented kids and drivers in the world who can all do a fast lap. But it's about just going that extra step and saying, how can I be better? How can I beat the other kids?" So young Max would pick up Joss's brain and pick Joss's brain while also constantly thinking about how he would improve. It also helped that he had the natural gift necessary to be a great driver. Outstanding reflexes, hand-eye coordination, the ability to focus, and a lack of fear. So here we see Max taking a nice little picture of himself here on page 36 and 37. Moving on to page 38, title, Under the Hood, and a note, there is no hood. So it has some little items that are mentioned here on pages 38 and 39 of identification of the car. Front wing. Downforce is essential in racing. It keeps the car low to the track, allowing for better handling. The front wing is shaped to create downforce and also improve the car's aerodynamic shape, which lets it cut through the air more easily. Halo. The protective halo that surrounds the driver's head was controversial when introduced in 2018, but it showed its worth several times, including in 2021 when it kept one of Verstappen's wheels off of Lewis Hamilton's head during a wreck. Rear wing. Like the front wing, the rear wing adds downforce to the car. The shape of the wing is designed to limit dirty air flowing over the wing. Cleaner air makes it easier for cars in its wake to pass, which leads to more exciting racing. Drag reduction. While creating downforce, the rear wing also slows the car down. At certain points on the track, a driver can activate the drag reduction system, DRS, which opens up the wing and gives the car a brief added burst of speed. Tires. At each race, teams are given the five types of tires. Two are for running in the rain, and the other three, called slicks, have varying degrees of hardness. The softer the tire, the better it handles, but the less durable it is, requiring more pit stops. Fuel. F1 does not allow refueling during the race. As the fuel is consumed, the car becomes lighter, affecting its handling, forcing the driver to adjust. The fuel used contains 10% ethanol as F1 moves toward fully sustainable fuel. And the engine? F1 cars use hybrid engines featuring an energy recovery system, ERS. Heat and kinetic energy given off when a car brakes are converted into electricity and stored in a battery. A button on the steering wheel allows the driver to use that energy for a boost. A Formula One car can travel at speeds in excess of 220 miles per hour, and even carts slide around the track at dizzying speeds. And since the driver is so low to the ground, it feels like the machine is moving even faster. A driver who thinks about the danger is a driver who won't last very long. Cycling through New York is also very dangerous, isn't it? Says Verstappen. I think there is a higher rate of having an incident there than what I have in F1. So it's just how you look at things. I mean, it's also easy to slip in the shower. On the move. Verstappen quickly worked his way up through the karting ranks, and by the time he was 17, he was driving in his first Formula One race. In the 2015 season, he became the youngest full-time driver in F1 history when he raced for Toro Rosso, which was then the equivalent of the B-team for the Red Bull Racing. The following year, he got the call up to Red Bull, and he won his first race in his debut with the team, becoming the youngest winner in F1 history, 18 years old, 228 days. Verstappen added 9 more Grand Prix victories and 3 top 4 world championship finishes in the next 4 years. He went into the 2021 season as one of the favorites to win the Drivers' Championship and break the stranglehold that Mercedes had put on the rest of F1. The team had won the previous 7 titles, with 6 of them captured by Lewis Hamilton. Hamilton and Verstappen would stage an epic battle throughout the 21 season. The pair finished 1-2 in 13 of the first 21 races of the 22-race season. Entering the finale in Abu Dhabi, they were tied atop the driver's standings. The race came down to the final lap. Hamilton had been leading, but a caution allowed Verstappen to catch up to Hamilton and ultimately pass him and drive his RB160B, the car he is playing with on the cover of this magazine, for the title. That happened last December, and the 2022 season didn't start until March. Verstappen was able to stay fresh by engaging in one of his favorite pastimes, sim racing. For years, drivers, especially in NASCAR, have used video games to learn the proper racing line at new tracks. And now e-racing has become so realistic that drivers use it as an even bigger training tool, as well as a way to have fun. It's becoming more and more professional, where it's the same real life, said Verstappen. You have to work on the setup strategy. You have to do your prep before you actually enter the event. For me, it's like I never really switch off in a way once I stop racing. F1 and I am in my off season. I still do the same things. I do pit stops and overtakes. I have to defend. I do long endurance races with teammates. So once I jump back in the F1 car, it feels like I never left. Fittingly, Verstappen picked up right where he left off when the 2022 season started, winning 5 of the first 8 races. Including in that run was a victory in the inaugural Miami Grand Prix in May. Formula One has historically struggled to make an impact in the United States. The 1991 United States Grand Prix was held in front of fewer than 20,000 fans in Phoenix, Arizona, and it was 9 years before another race was held in the States at Indianapolis Motor Speedway. That venue became most well known in F1 circles for a disastrous event in 2005 in which only 6 cars competed because none of the other teams had tires that were safe enough to race on. And TV ratings have historically been minuscule, in part because so many races are held in Europe and Asia and start early in the morning in the United States. Now, though, the sport is undergoing an American renaissance. A new facility in Austin, Texas, began hosting races in 2012. The popular Netflix show Formula One, Drive to Survive, has introduced the sport to a new group of fans. At the 2022 Miami Grand Prix, Verstappen and the rest of the drivers were treated like rock stars, as several celebrities like David Beckham, Michelle Obama, and Venus and Serena Williams were on hand. The wheel deal. And it's just about going that extra step and saying, how can I be better? How can I beat the other kids? So here are pictures on pages 40 and 41 of Verstappen after one of his finishes, standing up facing the crowd, and here he is in his car crossing the finish line, obviously in first place. World traveler, Verstappen is the center of attention no matter where he goes, from France far left and Austin near to venues where he won last year to Miami where he hobnobbing with Beckham and below in white. So here he is hobnobbing with Mr. Beckham and other famous people. And moving on to pages 42-43. If you've ever played a video game, you know how tricky it can be to keep track of which button does what. Now imagine driving a car going 200 miles per hour while playing a video game. With the controls above, F1 steering wheels differ by team, but they are adorned with knobs, buttons, and dials, as well as a screen that provides real-time data. Pictured is the wheel from Lewis Hamilton's 2020 car. Teams are kind of secretive when it comes to their current season setups. The buttons he uses the most are near the thumbs. The N button puts the car in neutral. PL makes it run out at pit lane speed, and the DRS button on activates the drag reduction system. Drivers can also change the way the car handles and brakes, either by adjusting the many knobs or by inputting a preset using the plus 10 and plus 1 buttons. If the engineers tell the driver to go to the setting 21, they'd hit the 10 twice and the 1 once. While the thumbs do the adjusting, a driver's fingers play a role in shifting gears. F1 cars don't have clutch pedals. Instead, there's a clutch paddle at the back of the steering wheel, as well as paddles to upshift and downshift. To succeed in F1 clearly takes more than a heavy foot. Steers of joy. Hamilton used this wheel to put his Mercedes to the 2020 F1 championship, the seventh of his career. Boy, looks like a spaceship cockpit there, doesn't it? And here on page 43, we have Max actually in a race. And obviously off to the races, Verstappen clinched his title with a cool, collected performance in Abu Dhabi. He's there on the right, then was consistently quick this year when the circuit came to Miami above, where he won and turned in the fastest lap. It was incredibly crowded on the track, but also in the city, says Verstappen. People were waiting in front of the hotel. Of course, we've had this already happen in European races, people trying to get pictures and stuff. But now you can really see the change in the United States. There'll be more change next year when the third United States race in Las Vegas is added to the schedule, giving another set of fans the chance to be dazzled by the fastest man around. Generation talents. Despite their positions, these stars have become their team's go-to scorers and achieved rare feats. We have a picture on the left, page 44, Joel Embiid scoring title win as a center. For more than 20 years, Hall of Famer Shaquille O'Neal reigned as the last center to lead the NBA in scoring after his 29.7 points per game in 1990 to 2000. The Big Diesel didn't seem happy about the distinction. Night after night on Inside the NBA, he pleaded for more barbecue chicken, big men throwing their elbows around in the paint. The rise of the three-pointer, however, made the NBA a shooter's league. From 2014 to 2021, seven straight scoring titles went to guards. Then this past season, Philadelphia's Joel Embiid averaged 30.6. In every sport, there are offensive positions and defensive positions. But all it takes is one player to redefine what's possible in a given role. Bobby Orr, George Mikan, Cal Ripken Jr., even Embiid plays a radically evolved game compared to Shaq's. The 76ers center made 93 threes last season. Shaq's made one in his whole career. Lately, there have been more and more such trailblazers, reaching heights at their position unseen for an entire generation. Is it a result of modern training? Players of all roles are now expected to be elite athletes. Or maybe it's the spread of position to systems. Whatever the reason, these stars are giving a new meaning to two-way player. Tina Charles, single-season center scoring record. Shaq's reign as the last center to win a scoring title only applied to the NBA. In that same span, it happened a handful of times in the WNBA. Most recently, Tina Charles led the league in 2021 with 23.4 points per game as a member of the Washington Mystics. In doing so, she broke the single-season points record for a center, set just 3 years earlier by Dallas's Liz Cambage, 23 points. It was the eighth time All-Star's first and only season with the Mystics following an off-season trade that netted multiple players and first-round picks for the New York Liberty. Charles had last paced the WNBA in points per game in 2016. In the span between centers who aren't Charles combined for three scoring titles, but the WA isn't a center-dominated league. It's star-dominated. Charles became the seventh player with multiple scoring championships in just 25 WNBA seasons. Nikola Jokic, back-to-back MVPs as a center. As good as Embiid was, he wasn't even the center on the All-NBA first team. The honor went to Nikola Jokic. Embiid became the first center since Moses Malone, bottom right, to average 30 points per game. Jokic was the first center since Malone to win back-to-back MVP awards. If the process has brought back the idea of the five as a team's best scorer, the Joker has proven that a big man can be his team's best everything. After this latest campaign, Jokic now owned five of the top 10 single-season assist averages for a center. His 8.3 assists per game in 2020 and 2021 trails only Wilt Chamberlain's 8.6 in 1967 and 68. But Jokic's consistency in all phases of the game sets him apart. He needs only four more triple-doubles to pass Chamberlain's career mark of 78. And if he can pull off a third straight MVP trophy, he'll join Chamberlain and Bill Russell as the only centers to ever do that. That's a picture of Jokic in action against Antetokounmpo of the Milwaukee Bucks. Salvador Perez, league leader in home runs as a catcher. The Royals' longtime catcher always had pop, but his calling card was his defense. A five-time Gold Glove winner, Perez won World Series MVP honors in 2015, despite not hitting a single home run during Kansas City's 4-1 series victory over the Mets. After missing the entirety of the 2019 recovering from Tommy John surgery, Perez returned during the pandemic shortened 20 season and hit an impressive 11 home runs in just 37 games, earning him his third Silver Slugger award. It seemed like a nice comeback for a veteran player, but also a fluke in small sample size. Perez returned in 2021, however, and actually started hitting homers more frequently, blowing away his career highs with 48 dingers and 121 RBIs. It helped that he played 161 games, including 40 as the Royals' designated hitter. He tied Vladimir Guerrero Jr. for the Major League lead in home runs, making him the first catcher atop that leaderboard since Johnny Bench, on the right, sought 40 over the fence for the Reds in 1972. Roman Yossi, 95 points as a defenseman. For a time, it seemed as if Roman Yossi would be the first defenseman since the Rangers' Brian Leetch in 1992 to finish the season with 100 points. The Predators' blue liner heated up down the stretch, recording 28 points in 14 games this March. Though he fell short of the century mark, his 96 points put him in elite company. It had been 29 years since Phil Housley last broke the 95-point barrier for a defenseman. In total, just eight defensemen have ever scored more in a single campaign. More amazing than Jossie's stats, however, was that he wasn't even favored to win the Norris Trophy for best defenseman for most of the season. Colorado's Cale Makar also had an amazing offensive season for a blue liner, scoring 28 goals and adding 58 assists. The age of the offensive defenseman may just be beginning. The WNBA veteran rookies. This season, more than a half dozen players at least 26 years old, all with international experience, have made their debut in the WNBA. Rebecca Gardner had been in the United States for just 4 days when she was inserted into the Chicago Sky's starting lineup on May 11th against the New York Liberty. The 6'1" guard had recently wrapped up her overseas season with Uni Girona in Spain, missing all of Chicago's training camp and logging just two practices with the reigning WNBA champions before suiting up against New York. At long last, 10 years after going unpicked in the WNBA draft, Gardner, who has played in Israel, Romania, Spain, and Turkey, finally made her stateside debut. The abrupt turnaround is why on the morning of the Sky's eventual 83-50 victory, Gardner told coach and general manager James Wade she was surprised by his decision to have her open the game. But despite her admission, the rookie guard also felt ready for her first WNBA contest because, well, she isn't exactly a traditional rookie either. Gardner had been playing professional basketball for a decade, having competed in Israel, Turkey, Romania, and Spain since finishing her collegiate career at UCLA in 2012. At 31 years old, Gardner became the oldest rookie to start in her WNBA debut since 2003. That definitely means a lot, she says. It's hard to explain in words. She is not alone in being a veteran of professional basketball, but a newcomer in the W. Through the end of May, according to Across the Timeline, there have been 7 debutantes this season who are at least 26 years old, the most since 2001. 3 of them, Gardner teammate forward Tina Kajisnik and Connecticut Sun guard Yvonne Anderson, are in their early 30s. We have the talent, and now we're finally getting our opportunity, says Anderson, who turned 32 in March. You just want the people to root for us with the same vigor they root for younger players. We all want to play at the highest level. Anderson, like Gardner, has carved out a successful career as a basketball nomad. The daughter of St. John's men's basketball coach Mike Anderson, she admits she was a little spoiled by the resources provided by the University of Texas, where she played 4 seasons. A prime example came after graduation when Anderson moved to Sweden. While there, she remembers relying on a bicycle to get around, recalling one particular instance when she was riding to a grocery store but face-planted trying to make a left turn during a snowfall. I guess I could have been smarter not riding the bike in the snow, she says, but it's not something that I used to do. The sport has subsequently also taken her to Australia, Luxembourg, Greece, Turkey, and most recently, Italy. Anderson is also a naturalized citizen of Serbia, having played a key role on the team's 4th place finish at the Tokyo Olympics last summer. Such experiences not only helped her game develop and raise her profile with the WNBA front offices, but also introduced her to much of the league's top talent, as a large swath of players go abroad when the season concludes. Roughly half the league's athletes played overseas in 2022. I knew I could play basketball at a really high level, says Anderson, who plays 13 minutes in her debut versus the Los Angeles Sparks on May 14th. And what my journey taught me is I just had more time to get better by working, more time to learn myself and to grow. That's why I'm here. Why at 32 I'm getting the opportunity now. We've run out of time for today's episode of Sports Illustrated for Kids. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm John Ivey, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sports Illustrated for Kids is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.